Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, we present our top five movies to teach an alien about Earth, which is a fascinating topic, Matty. But considering it's July 4th weekend, I think we should just teach aliens about America. You're not above a little old-fashioned jingoism, are you?
Not at all. By the way, Mr. Alien, if you have any oil, you are more than welcome to come by.
We'll take it.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Dan Byrne. Oh, we haven't had Dan Byrne on the show in a while. And the second movie in our classic heist marathon, Stanley Kubrick's The Killing.
We'll also have some thoughts on Gonzo, the new documentary chronicling the life and work of Hunter S. Thompson. But first, we will spend a few minutes anyway on Will Smith's latest Independence Day blockbuster, Hancock.
Hancock's latest act of so-called heroics took a hefty financial toll.
You save people's lives every single day. People should love you.
I look like I care what people think.
Adam, in honor of July 4th, I'm going to engage in the most American of activities, bitching about taxes. Currently in Cook County, home of Matty Ballgame Enterprises, we pay the highest sales tax in the entire nation. Now, given that, I dread to think what the good residents of Metropolis and Gotham City have to pay in city taxes. I can just imagine the evening news. Once again, Superman saved us from annihilation, but in the process, tore up three city blocks and a water treatment plant. The city estimates the damage at $7 million. Adam, who pays for that? Does the Metropolis City Council have a Superman rainy day fund? I just imagine people avoiding living in Metropolis proper, you know, rather living in the collar communities and commuting in to avoid having to pay the Superman tax.
Sure.
What I love about Hancock, or at least the premise of Hancock, the movie we have this week, is that it offers us a superhero who needs to deal with the consequences of operating in our world. Hancock, played by Will Smith, is a drunk, apparently homeless superhero who, in the process of saving Los Angeles, ends up destroying lots of it. So I ask you, Adam, is it fun to see our superheroes in this summer of superheroes saddled with lawsuits and civic ordinances? Or would you rather go back to the Hulk smashing up the sidewalk without having to worry which city maintenance department you need to call to clean it up?
Well, I certainly didn't mind the spin on the superhero movie they were going for here. You're right, certainly at least in premise, in concept, it's a neat one. And I like where the movie was going, what they were going for here. Though, like with the Hulk, maybe no surprise here, I generally could have done with less need for cleanup. I think there's a little too much destruction here for my taste throughout the entire movie. I will say, though, that I expected to hate this movie, and I came out a lot more entertained than I thought I'd be. I do like Jason Bateman here as this PR exec who's trying to turn around Hancock's image, and he manages to be pretty funny despite the script hanging him out to dry in a lot of instances. But I mainly was entertained here because of Will Smith. Even if his drunk Hancock character, I think, is truly a character in terms of his mannerisms, it's Will Smith trying to play something, and his sober Hancock is really just Will Smith, at least in terms of their physicality. But, you know, newsflash, Will Smith is just insanely likable and fun to watch, and he salvages a lot of this movie with his conviction and his charisma. That all said, it did ultimately wear me down, or maybe I should say specifically director Peter Berg ultimately wore me down. I think his approach to this film visually is all over the place. He labors to make the film feel authentic and gritty with these ugly close-ups and obstructed shots. You know, we've got sort of this Michael Mann thing going on where he's got cameras behind people's ears and things. And then he mixes that with this Transformers-style chaos and special effects-driven action scenes, all while also presenting that in the context of what is basically just a cute action comedy. Everything about the way this film was shot was distracting, I thought, and at odds with the characters. It didn't work.
You know, I was so curious, actually, to hear what you had to say about this film. And I'm actually really curious to see what our listeners have to say about this film, because there are so many different ways to read this movie. Mm-hmm. Is it a spoof? Is it a straight superhero film? And I had one that came to me this morning while in the shower. Maybe it's a geopolitical commentary. I mean, if you think about it, Hancock, John Hancock, is America.
Yeah.
And he kicks ass. and it's messy when he does it. But justice is messy, and in the end, the French get theirs. And overall, I was actually pretty entertained by this. I think you're absolutely right. You put your finger on it. You're placing the blame on Peter Berg. Mm-hmm. I think the unevenness of this film, and it really is, I felt like I was watching a film that had been filtered down by rewrites, studio notes, and focus group suggestions ad nauseum, because the premise here is really, really intriguing. And you're right, Peter Berg plays up, you know, the sort of the grittiness here and there. I'm guessing there was a lot more, but I'm guessing the studio took one look at this and said, no. No
yeah,
way.
More special effects.
We're not going to have an R-rated film. Play up the comedy. Play up the mindless action. And so you get these, what I thought were really sort of gritty, heartfelt scenes. The scenes I really liked actually in the prison. I thought they were great. Whether in the support group, those worked. And there was not a lot.
Mostly montage stuff.
Right. But. And there wasn't a lot of overscoring there, but it was getting at something. And then you juxtapose that against these other scenes where you have music telling us how to feel.
Oh, I know.
And this, at one point, the theme song from Sanford and Son plays, and it's this middle school gross-out humor. It just didn't work, and I think that's why it left me feeling kind of messy and uneven, but I don't place the blame on Berg. I actually kind of like this film.
I can see that, because as I said, I was a lot more entertained by this film than I thought I'd be. I did get a fair number of laughs out of it, but for me, it really was Peter Berg holding me back.
Did you laugh more during this or Get Smart?
I actually probably laugh more at this.
Yeah.
This is definitely more entertaining than Get Smart.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Exactly. Now just think about it. I think the studio had, I mean, I guess the script has been in Hollywood for years. Mm-hmm. I think it was originally titled Tonight He Comes, and a bunch of people walked away from the project. But just imagine, I mean, here's a guy that flies around with a fifth of gin saving people.
Yeah.
That's great. Just imagine where you can go there. And I think Berg is trying to do that, but the studio, there's no way the studio is going to let him do that.
Maybe not, but I don't give Berg that much credit. I'm sorry. I just don't. I don't think he knew what he was going for here, because like I said, visually this film was an absolute hodgepodge, and it really was tiresome, I thought. And you're right about some of the musical choices in terms of the lack of creativity here. I mean, come on, when he goes to jail, we see him walking down the stairs to go into general population. They play Colors, a song from, you know, the 80s, the Dennis Hopper movie. I mean, give me a break. It's just really kind of tired and played out. And you could tear into a lot of little things about this movie. I mean, Jason Bateman's character is supposedly this PR genius, and yet we see him constantly pitching this all-heart thing. Any PR genius is going to be able to read a crowd, read his audience better than that, and not be so naive and stupid. It didn't make any sense. And there's this big action set piece in the middle of the film, which felt like maybe the studio said, okay, here we need some action. Mm-hmm. It's getting a little too plaintive and serious. And we get this showdown, that's all I'll say, between Hancock and another character, and the whole thing feels like it really was taken out of Transformers. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense in terms of the characters that we've seen built throughout the rest of the film. It relies on stupid coincidences in order to move the plot forward. It's just really bad. I got nothing out of any of those big visual scenes in terms of the special effects. I couldn't stand them.
You're right. That special effects in that scene are really sort of down, but I did like that relationship that you referred to and the way it was building. It was going somewhere, but then unfortunately the last third of the film sort of devolves into this boring origin story.
Oh, yeah.
I am so tired of origin stories, and that's one of the things I thought was really refreshing about The Incredible Hulk, is that just put it in the it in the opening. You know,
mm-hmm.
we get it. You know, that's all we need. Get us up to speed.
Sure.
And then this thing sort of devolves, and also, again, you don't have a great villain. This is the summer of bad villains. We need you, Heath Ledger.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear his music sort of
He's
swelling
coming.
In the background. And it becomes, again, they needed this villain to sort of move the plot forward, and you're right. That's what this movie becomes. Basically, they're trying to find anything to get us towards the end so that we can get our glimpse at what might be a sequel and credits.
The Edge. There is no honest way to explain it, because the only people who really know where it is are the ones who have gone over.
He was a reporter with a wild imagination.
He was not afraid to express himself in sometimes shocking ways.
I'm not at all embarrassed at the use of the word freak.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It starts off like a rocket. That was mad genius.
Ralph, when he first met Hunter, he'd never done any drugs. He loses it.
Hunter always had to have a running crisis.
Maddie, I'd like to start with a quote here from the movie we just heard a clip from, of course, Gonzo, the life and work of Hunter S. Thompson. The quote is, "There is no way to grasp what a shallow, contemptible, and hopelessly dishonest old hack Hubert Humphrey really is until you followed him around for a while on the campaign trail. Hubert Humphrey is a treacherous, gutless old ward healer." Those words written and spoken by the Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson. You hear them roughly halfway through Alex Gibney's new documentary. during the section on Thompson's coverage of the McGovern campaign for Rolling Stone in the early 70s, coverage that ultimately led to his book, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. And I bring those remarks up, Maddie, because as astute film spotting listeners may recall, Hubert Humphrey happens to be one of your great Minnesotan heroes. So my question for you is, were you able to overlook Thompson's slanderous comments and enjoy the film? Or were you so incensed that you pulled out a handgun and went gonzo on your DVD player?
Hubert Humphrey, one of my favorite politicians. Luckily, Hunter S. Thompson, one of my favorite writers.
Balances it out.
I absolutely know how he feels about Mr. Humphrey, and actually, he's right. By the time he's writing, Humphrey in the 70s had become a shell of his former self. He wasn't this paragon of virtue, you know, leading us out of the darkness for civil rights. He was a Washington bureaucrat. He really was, and he's absolutely right. He's
okay.
An empty suit. And it was during that portion of the film, actually, that I enjoyed it the most,
mm-hmm.
when he's on the campaign trail,
too.
Because he's so disillusioned by that election. And at that point, the film actually offers, I think, what you can pretty much surmise as a thesis. And that's, it's his disillusionment with that election that leads to, when he deals with the 2004 election,
mm-hmm.
he can't handle it and actually kills himself because of it. That was the most interesting. The sort of the opening is really nice. We get his time with Hell's Angels, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But it lost me in the last third, because Hunter S. Thompson becomes a monster, and he becomes a caricature of himself,
yeah.
quite literally in Doonesbury, and he becomes a rock star. He becomes a demagogue, and I think this film lets him off the hook.
You do.
I really do. I think Hunter, I mean, it may be sort of misplaced criticism to say that the father of gonzo journalism probably deserves a gonzo documentary.
Maybe.
And I think this sort of comes off as a soft A&E biography at the end. He's cheating on his wife. He's basically destroying himself with drugs. He's basically a shut-in. His writing is terrible up to the end. And he turns his back when liberals probably need him most.
Right.
They need a loud-mouthed, gun-toting prophet to fight against what they feel is injustice. What does he do? He kills himself.
He cashes in.
Yeah, exactly. And so I really feel that it sort of lets him off the hook. It's just a little too expository throughout. I wanted just a little bit more gonzo here.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. I do know where you're coming from. But for me, even though it let him off the hook a little bit, that's because Gibney was very clearly trying to put the emphasis back on his work.
Mm-hmm.
It is called The Life and Work, not Death of Hunter mm-hmm. S. Thompson. And for that, I really do thank him, and I appreciated it. This movie did work for me. I'm not going to put it on the same level as Taxi to the Dark Side, his Oscar-winning documentary about torture from earlier in the year. And I actually remember when I saw Gonzo originally at Sundance, I came away a little underwhelmed. I didn't like the way it started off, especially with these digitally shot reenactments of Thompson, you know,
yeah,
pounding away his typewriter.
That's right before the opening credits. Is that an HDNet thing?
I don't know, but it really doesn't work. And then you get Johnny Depp intoning Thompson's words, which really doesn't do much for me personally. And I was put off by the beginning of it. But the reason I do really like this movie and recommend it is I think that there are a lot of people out there like me who really only knows Hunter S. Thompson, the mythical figure,
mm-hmm.
Gonzo or Raoul Duke or whatever name you want to give to that rock star figure that he was, that he became that character of himself. And I think Gibney does spend some time on that character and even show how Thompson eventually kind of succumbed to that image. But what I didn't really know about Thompson was his actual work. Some of the excerpts we get here from Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail.
You've never read Fear and Loathing?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
I have it at home, but I haven't read it yet. From his Hell's Angels book, his comment about Pat Buchanan, calling him, and I quote, a half-crazed Davy Crockett running around the parapets of Nixon's Alamo.
And the best part about it is that Buchanan actually says it in the film.
He gives the line, and that means something because the line is so good. It's such a good, well-written, funny line that even Buchanan remembers it fondly and laughs at it. And then later, even though it's true that near the end of his life, certainly his writing had degraded as well as his body and mind and everything else, but his words the day after 9/11. Actually, I want to go ahead and play a scene from the movie here so we can hear them.
We're going to punish somebody for this attack, but just who or what will be blown to smithereens is hard to say. Maybe Afghanistan, maybe Pakistan, or Iraq. This is going to be a very expensive war, and victory is not guaranteed for anyone. And certainly not for anyone as baffled as George W. Bush. He will declare a national security emergency and clamp down hard on everybody, no matter where they live or why. Winston Churchill once said the first casualty of war is always the truth. The lid is on. Loose lips sink ships. Don't say anything that might give aid to the enemy.
I'm sorry, you don't need to be a bleeding heart liberal to hear that and admit that Thompson absolutely nailed the past 7 years,
yes,
the day after 9/11. So he still had something in him. He still had a little bit of that insight, that profound insight in him, and his ability to express it that really was amazing, I think, for me. And learning about the role he had in the McGovern campaign, how he covered that for Rolling Stone, and in a lot of ways turned the country on to McGovern, and Jimmy Carter later by covering his Law Day speech at the University of Georgia, that was all stuff I didn't know. And that was all stuff that was very interesting to me, and it made me appreciate his work in a way that I didn't before.
Well, those are all a litany of things, the reasons why I love Hunter S. Thompson. So, of course, for me, what I was looking for were those last 7 years.
Mm.
What was he doing? And what I did not like about this film, you sort of got at it with the Johnny Depp reading his stuff, is
right,
that why did it spend so much time showing us clips from this movie,
Fear and
Loathing in Las Vegas? Only one time does Hunter S. Thompson ever talk about it. I mean, it's a completely troubled project. A lot of people have disowned it. And there's an interesting story there, but we don't get any of that. Instead, we get these clips, which really don't serve to play up who this man was. We even get one clip from Where the Buffalo Roam. It didn't make any sense.
No.
But you're absolutely right. The way that it deals with Hunter in the mid-70s, he was a man for his time, and he captured it absolutely perfectly. And so that's why I am, of course, recommending people see it. I just think it could have dug the knife in just a little bit further.
Yeah, I think it could have as well. But I do know I caught Alex Gibney on Charlie Rose, actually, I think over the weekend. And he did say that he specifically tried to just focus the movie on the prime of his work. That was his clear agenda. And so for me, that was enough.
Well, obviously that works. Obviously, I felt that, well, then why do you need the coda? Why do you need that at
right,
the end?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, other than where do you end it except with his death? I mean, you have to get there eventually. But I know he was trying to focus it. It was enough for me. We are both recommending the film. And Gonzo is out now in limited release. Hancock is in theaters everywhere. If you see either film and agree or disagree with our take, send us an email. feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also share your comments by audio via voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. Hey guys, I was really excited to hear your top five this week, but then extremely let down. The vacuum left in your list by the absence of Brad Pitt was unimaginable.
Oh, the angst.
Listener feedback is next. Stay with us.
She said love, love, love is everything. I said, okay, guess whatever. She said, what does that mean? I said, nothing, it's just good to have a backup plan. She said, I guess that means you don't got love. I said, maybe I love everyone. She said, that's the same as loving no one. I said, okay, I guess, whatever. I have a dream of a new American language, one with a little bit more Spanish. I have a dream of a new pop music that tells the truth with a good beat and some nice harmony.
Hi guys, it's Joel from Seattle, Washington. Just saw WALL-E, and I gotta say, I agree with everything that you guys said, except for one little piece of it, which was, I don't really agree with the use of the live-action characters. I think that's the one thing that kind of diminished from the whole experience and took away from it. But other than that, fantastic movie, loved it from the first frame, and love the show, guys. Keep up the great work.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. He's Maddie. I'm Adam, and we got a voicemail there. Sound a little funny to you, Matt?
Patent pending. Dollar. Dollar in the jar, please.
Stealing your line. Joel there with a voicemail, agreeing with everything we said about WALL-E, though we did have an issue with the live-action characters. And I know you brought up you didn't really like the way they meshed the live-action with the animated characters either, but we will get into all of that perhaps on next week's show as we get into listener feedback on the new Pixar film, WALL-E. First, we wanted to share the results of last week's poll question, we wanted to know if you will be rushing out to see WALL-E. And this poll question, our choices anyway, caused some confusion last week, Maddie. The choices were, yes, I have to take the kids. Yes, the kids have to take me, / I can't wait. Maybe I'm not really an animation guy or gal. Or finally, nope, I'm renting Short Circuit. So, Maddie, how did it come out, and where did the confusion come from?
Well, overall, number one, yes, the kids have to take me, 51%. And the problem is that I was actually tasked to come up with this poll last week, and I didn't understand the literal nature of all of our listeners.
I know.
The kids have to take me, or I don't have any kids. I thought that was implied. I was just having a little fun.
Yes.
Next week, you know, obviously I've been taking off that duty. Yes, I have to take the kids in at 21%. Maybe I'm not really an animation guy, gal, 17%. Nope, I'm renting Short Circuit, 11%.
Well, if my math is correct anyway, that's 72% who said yes. So obviously a lot of interest in WALL-E. Not a surprise to see that. This week's poll question, it actually relates to an upcoming review on the show. Next week we're planning on discussing the new Guillermo del Toro film, Hellboy 2. We want to know which of those three acclaimed Mexican directors, the group of guys who are producing each other's films and are really collaborators in a lot of ways, which of those three acclaimed Mexican directors is your favorite? Maddie, the choices are, and we're going to preface this by saying, you, and if it wasn't you, it would be me, are probably going to butcher these names.
Alfonso Cuarón, the director of Children of Men, Y Tu Mama Tambien. Guillermo del Toro, Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth. Or Alejandro González Iñárritu, the director of Amoros Perros and Babel.
You say Babel. I say Babel. Let's call the whole thing off. Vote in this week's poll question at filmspotting.net. Let us know which one of those three directors is your favorite. Maddie, do you have a choice you want to weigh in right now?
I'm gonna give myself a good week and before I weigh in on this, because actually I enjoy all three.
Okay, well, I respect all three filmmakers as well. I would probably go right now with Alfonso Cuarón because of Y Tu Mama Tambien and Children of Men. I think he's probably the most talented director there, though Del Toro is probably close. We do want to know what you think. Again, please vote in the poll at filmspotting.net. We're going to get into the mailbag here in a second. Got a lot of great stuff on our actor-director duos and also our top five loneliness movies from last week. But first, we do have two quick notes. First of all, War Games, Maddie. I saw this email. Did you have the pleasure of seeing War Games growing up on that Minnesota farm in the 80s?
No, I'm not familiar.
It's returning to theaters, 300 select movie theaters on Thursday, July 24th. You can get more information about it at fathomevents.com. Just wanted to mention that I may actually have to go see War Games, and Maddie, apparently I have to drag you with me.
You do?
Yeah.
If you say so, you give me burden. You have never steered me wrong.
That's true. I haven't. Well, we do want to get onto something much more important, though, Maddie. More important than War Games, even. We want to say congratulations to one Sam Van Halgren, former Film Spotting co-host, and his lovely wife, Carrie, on the birth of their son.
Exactly. David Joseph Samuel Van Halgren. Wow.
Yeah.
Five names.
As if Van Halgren wasn't unwieldy enough, David Joseph Samuel Van Halgren. We love it. We do want to say congratulations and, of course, our best to Sam and Carrie. I think we're going to go up, actually, a week from now, maybe, and check out the new kid. I'm really disappointed that they didn't go with David Soderbergh Van Halgren, but what are you going to do?
David Herzog Van Halgren.
Exactly. Well, for the next child, perhaps. Let's get into the mailbag then, Maddie. We shared some responses last week to our top five actor-director duos, but really just kind of skimmed the surface. Want to dive in here a little more in depth. Why don't you start with this one from Jesse?
All right. He's writing in from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hey, guys, I was really excited to hear your top five list this week, but then extremely let down. The vacuum left in your list by the absence of Brad Pitt, David Fincher, was unimaginable. Though they may only have two collaborations as of now, both were gems. Seven and Fight Club are arguably two of the top movies of the last 15 years. I know Adam thinks so. Brad Pitt isn't always a breathtaking actor, but the what's in the box scene in Seven and the I want you to hit me as hard as you can scene in Fight Club are genius only Fincher can pull from him. Plus, they are at it again with The Curious Case of Benjamin Button coming this December. Maybe once that hits theaters, you won't forget this collaboration the next time you put a list like this together. What say you, oh, number one chair of the Brad Pitt fan club, Adam Kempner?
Well, I've got a few comments here. First of all, we didn't forget Brad Pitt and David Fincher. At least I didn't. I actually did have him on my short list, and he just ultimately didn't make the cut for a variety of reasons.
You had to have done three movies to make my list.
Yeah, actually, I don't know that I set that number, but two movies wasn't enough, even though I do know they have Benjamin Button coming. as you mentioned, I'm not a big Brad Pitt fan, so that also hurt Brad Pitt's chances of making this list. And I do also want to say that Seven and Fight Club, both good movies. I wouldn't put Fight Club in that hallowed ground of top two movies of the last 15 years, but I actually probably would put Seven in there. So I'm not surprised he made Jesse's list, and Jesse really wanted to see him. Other listeners wrote in, certainly mentioned them as well. But yeah, the number of films between them and my dislike generally for Brad Pitt, just not enough to make my list. Let's get on to this one from Michael Bratmo in Lund, Sweden. I was, if anything, surprised that neither of you gave Chow Yun-Fat and John Woo some love, not even as an honorable mention. They made films like A Better Tomorrow, The Killer, and Hard Boiled together, and invented the now often used fire two guns while jumping through the air in slow motion. In 2007, they even made a video game in which you can fire two guns while jumping through the air in slow motion. How many other actor-director combos have done that? Without them, there would be no Matrix, no Pulp Fiction, and no Sin City. In other words, a far less awesome world.
Well, continuing this thought, Ben Yakshaw from Columbus, Ohio writes in, I think Woo gets most of the credit for their success, but let's not forget that these same movies established Chow Yun-Fat as one of the greatest all-time action actors, that I find him so captivating in these outings despite having never seen one with a coherent translation is a testament to his charisma and acting prowess. It speaks volumes that neither has been nearly as awesome in their subsequent careers.
You know what speaks volumes about these choices? The use of the word awesome. Twice.
That's pretty
talking
awesome.
About it is Chow Yun-Fat and John Woo. I like that a lot. Wanted to read both of them for that reason, but they both make really good cases. Michael, of course, being a little bit more humorous, but I like those films. I haven't seen A Better Tomorrow, so that kind of hurt their chances for my list, but I really like Ben's point about the fact that they were better together than they were separately, which really was kind of an unwritten criterion.
Well, I wonder if that would make a top five list in and of itself. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. I mean, Joe Pesci needs Martin Scorsese. Bruce Campbell certainly needs Sam Raimi. Does Sam Raimi need Bruce Campbell? I don't know.
Well, that is a really intriguing question. I think a lot of our listeners would say yes, and I think we're going to hear a little bit about Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell maybe in this next email from Jared in Dorchester. He says, I have a few that quickly came to mind. John Hughes made three of his best movies in 1984 and 1985, casting Anthony Michael Hall perfectly as the geek. I'm with you. Trilogy of greatness there.
Why not John Hughes and John Cryer? I think they were really at the top of their games.
Number two from Jared, the Evil Dead franchise is nothing if Sam Raimi doesn't cast Bruce Campbell as Ash. Raimi continues to use him in cameos that are always fun to watch for, I agree. And his number one, this is a great one. I felt really bad about leaving it out. My favorite duo has got to be John Cassavetes and his wife Jenna Rollins. These two had such an understanding of what they wanted from each other, and it comes across brilliantly. I think Rollins' performances with Cassavetes' direction stands alone in the whole history of cinema. I think Jared's probably right, and that's a case, and another listener said this, I don't think we included this email, but they made a really good point when talking about Jenna Rollins. I actually want to say it was our friend Ryan Heller from Aberdeen City. He mentioned that we should have included people like that pairing that really almost can't live without each other. And of course, they were married, but can't make films without each other versus just they bring out the best in each other.
It sounds like another top five.
Yeah.
We'll save it for the end of the summer. All right, well, Rick Price from Manchester, England writes in, I was just waiting for this collaboration during your top five last week. Where, oh, where was Tim Burton and Johnny Depp in any of your lists? Not even an honorable mention? Tim Burton's best work seems to involve Johnny. You got Edward Scissorhands, showed that Johnny Depp was not just a pretty face, as most of it was covered in prosthetic scars, and Tim put his distinctive twist on the Frankenstein's monster. Ed Wood, one of Burton's best and most critically acclaimed films, seems to be his most personal, while Depp just disappears into Edward D. Wood Jr., possibly my favorite role Depp has ever played. Sleepy Hollow, camp horror, fantastically creepy and put over the top at times. Depp hams up Crane's character like a prepubescent little girl. Burton revels in the gothic visuals. And then you have Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, closer to the book than the Mel Stewart version, a whole lot darker and more fun. Depp's socially awkward Willy Wonka hit right on the money for me. And then Sweeney Todd. He hasn't seen it yet. I'm just upset that this pairing missed your list completely, guys. You just know that there is going to be more. Well, and he's absolutely right. I certainly did consider it. You know, it's funny because Burton lets Depp try anything.
Mm-hmm.
He really sort of empowers him. And one where it really went wrong for me was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yes.
Here he is trying something. He's obviously doing this sort of Michael Jackson character, whatever. Uh-huh. And Depp, he's a brilliant, brilliant actor. But I think another director is going to step in and say, you know what? This just isn't working this time. This choice is just not working. I need you to try something else. And Burton didn't do that here, and so we end up with what I thought was a real mess.
Yeah, it is a mess. I didn't enjoy the film, and I hated Johnny Depp's performance in it. And I hated it so much, in fact, that it laid waste to all the other good performances he has given in those other movies that Rick mentioned, which probably is unfair. But I do like most of those movies. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, though, just killed me and really kind of soured me on that collaboration. Though they made up for it with Sweeney Todd, a movie I didn't love, but I really loved Depp's performance in it. Nevertheless, didn't quite make the list. Let's go ahead and move on to our top five loneliness movies. This was our top five list from last week, tying in with our review of WALL-E. And Sean Lane in Chicago mentions Castaway, of course, having a four-year relationship with a volleyball qualifies as lonely, and Remains of the Day.
Oh, man,
I know.
Great choice.
Having an unrequited 14-year relationship with Emma Thompson also qualifies. Sean, I'm guilty as charged. I feel shame, actually, because that one had a chance to make my top five had I remembered it. I really like that movie that much. Castaway, not so much, maybe in the top 20, but Remains of the Day would have been up there.
Man, I am humbled. And I am further humbled by Freddie Cardozo from Atlanta, originally from Paraguay. I felt compelled to add three suggestions to your list of top movies about loneliness, which you may have considered or not. The Station Agent, Away From Her. It's one of those things. When we first come up with the idea of what we're going to do at the beginning of the week, The Station Agent was on my short list. You know,
yeah.
I started running through my mind, but by the end of the week, I had just completely forgotten about it, and I would have at least given it an honorable mention.
Yeah, I probably would have given it an honorable mention. Scott Hamm in Centerport, New York. I don't have a full top five to give you, but one film that would be in my personal pantheon that applies tremendously to this list is Groundhog Day. Phil Connor's isolation manifests itself into the nightmare of living the same day over and over until he finally opens himself up to the world around him. The film works as a broad comedy, but also is one of the most unique romantic comedies ever made. Are you buying what Scott's selling, Maddie?
I absolutely love Groundhog Day, and yeah, I will buy it. He does discover by the end of the movie, man, what a shallow life I'm leading. I really am lonely, and of
mm-hmm.
course, yeah, definitely should have made my list.
Yeah, it's a great choice. Wouldn't have been in my top five, but it absolutely applies. And, you know, John Heberle, just want to list his real quick, Maddie. He's got some great titles that deserve mentioning
right.
here.
Right, Memento, Requiem for a Dream, Lost in Translation, This is England, a great film from last year, and number one, Magnolia.
All fantastic picks. And really, Requiem for a Dream, you talk about earlier in the week when the movies just start percolating, your choices start kind of brewing in your mind. That was one of the first ones in my mind. I can just hear Ellen Burstyn saying, I'm lonely. That one absolutely is a good pick there. We appreciate all the great feedback. As always, please email any other comments or suggestions to feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, we'll share some more of your top five movies about loneliness and reactions to WALL-E.
And there's a lot of them. Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater. And you like money. You got a great big dollar sign there where most women have a heart. Our classic heist marathon goes to the races with Stanley Kubrick and The Killing. Stay with us.
Back road, New Mexico. There's an old abandoned church. Windows boarded up. Never sees a coat of paint. Sometimes I drive by and dream. Of hearing the preacher preach. It's a drag strip for the kids. You can hear them tires screech. Don't let your heart get broken by this world. Don't let your heart get broken. At the bottom of the ocean, you might find a pearl. Don't let your heart.
It's time now to take a look at what is new on DVD this week. Coming out this Tuesday, Maddie, not a whole lot worth mentioning. We have three movies here. First, The Future is Unwritten. This is the Julian Temple documentary about Joe Strummer. You saw this. I saw it at Sundance, actually, I think maybe 2 years ago now, and did really like it. You weren't into it as much as I was.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I must really get off on the downfall of people because I had the same problem that I had with Gonzo. I wanted to see Joe Strummer at his lowest, this sort of disintegration. I mean, here's a guy who loves fame. He loves being Joe Strummer, and he will do anything to get that fame back again. So, you know, in the end, it was kind of the same experience I had with Gonzo.
Well, I really liked the form of it, and actually a little more Gonzo in its style than the movie Gonzo
was. Yeah, you're right,
I did appreciate that about it. It's funny, Maddie, you're really into documentaries. I actually think you're very hard on documentaries.
Sorry.
Maybe more so than I am.
I would say exacting.
Exacting, okay. Demanding in some ways. Well, The Future is Unwritten is out now. As is Stop Loss, the new film from Kimberly Pierce with Ryan Phillippe.
I would like to go on record as saying I would recommend Joe Strummer, The Future is Unwritten, any day
over stop loss.
Yeah, definitely. We were not big fans of that film, but if you want to check it out, it does include audio commentary from Kimberly Pierce, who also made Boys Don't Cry. It has another commentary by the co-writer, Mark Richard. And then finally, The Tracy Fragments. This is a film with Ellen Page. It played at Toronto along with Juno. I didn't catch it. Didn't look all that intriguing to me, and it kind of came and went from theaters and mostly got trashed. I don't know. Maybe it's worth checking out. It's out now on DVD.
All right. Well, now we want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we really are humbled by each and every donation. It goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. So thank you, thank you, thank you, too. Oh, we got Silver Club donors this week. James from Houston, Texas. Jonathan from right here in Chicago. Alex from Dallas. Jetta from Maka, Saudi Arabia.
Love that.
Wow. That's that. I mean, it really is so cool to be in this position and really to hear, you know, any feedback we get when from all over the
mm-hmm.
world.
It's
so
amazing.
It's so rewarding. We also want to thank Dean from Pompano Beach, Florida. Amber, again, from right here in Chicago. Andreas from Oslo, Norway. I got to take back everything bad I have said about Norwegians.
I think they actually donate the more you talk about them. So keep it up, Maddie. Come on.
Gil from Yarraville, Victoria, Australia. Thank you so much, Gil. As I said, we are taking over down there. Sean from Chula Vista, California. Eric from Orlando, Florida. Thank you, guys. And remember that for every $10 you donate, your name entered into the Film Spotting hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name. You get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and you can click on the donation tab. It's right there at the top of the page.
Yeah, and we will have another edition of After Hours here in a couple weeks. And we heard from Peter in Seattle, our last listener's choice winner, and he gave us three choices. They were The Counterfeiters, recent foreign language film, Scoop, a recent Woody Allen film, and the all-time great, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. I think we're going to let down our listeners when we tell them that we went with
Scoop.
We did. We're going to review Scoop. The Counterfeiters, just, Maddie, you already saw it, maybe seemed like a little bit of a downer, didn't want to get into on After Hours. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai seem maybe like too much fun for After Hours. We really do want to check out this Woody Allen film. I think it looks terrible. It's why I never bothered to see it. But Peter had good things to say about it, so we are going to give it a shot. We will talk about that Woody Allen-Scarlett Johansson collaboration on After Hours in a few weeks.
They're so hot right now.
Mm-hmm.
Who should we vote for? They're more your crowd than mine. I know.
Well, let's vote for ourselves.
Oh.
Why not?
So please don't vote for ourselves.
Come on. To the devil with false modesty.
The devil.
Welcome back to Film Spotting, everybody. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week, we massacred the scene you just heard between Sissy Spacek and the greatest American hero, William Catt. Can you sing the theme song?
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. You didn't think I'd know the greatest American hero? I love that show.
Of course, from Brian De Palma's Carrie. Now, can you imagine Star Wars with William Catt as Luke Skywalker and Kurt Russell as Han Solo?
Don't give me nightmares like that.
They both read for the parts.
Wow. Do not give me nightmares. That sounds awful. It was, of course, a tie-in with our top five movies about loneliness. Wanted to share this email we got, Maddie, from Paul Trapp in Marblehead, Massachusetts. I just watched Carrie with my son, a ninth grader in high school, and decided it should be mandatory viewing for all incoming freshman classes. It's easy to regard Carrie as a blood-soaked revenge flick, but the empathetic look at Carrie's loneliness in high school and at home delivers the film's strongest message. Have some compassion for students on the fringes. Hear, hear.
Very, very well said.
Yeah, very well said. We agree completely. And actually, Carrie, maybe Brian De Palma's last good film.
Oh, you just got to get it in there, don't you?
Yeah,
just got to dig the knife. Come on, man. Have you forgotten about The Untouchables?
The line was better if I pretended The Untouchables didn't happen.
All right, well, reach your hand into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Andy, they're all going to laugh at me, Shepper, from Crestview Hills, Kentucky. Maddie, where
all
is
All right,
it?
Crestview Hills. Well, hills, I'm going to go along the river then, which I'm going to say leaves out Lexington. I'm going to say it's outside the Queen City of Cincinnati.
You saw the email, didn't you? You're totally cheating.
No, I didn't.
You're absolutely right. It's near Cincinnati.
Really?
Yeah, Andy said it was near Cincinnati. So nicely done, Mr. Geography. Maddie Ballgame, and nicely done to Andy. Congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Maddie, this one really needs no setup whatsoever. We're going to dive right into it. I started off, you direct.
And action.
I must go.
Take me with you.
I cannot. You will die there.
Do you think I care?
I care. Now, tell me again how to say goodbye.
Kiss me and tell me you love me.
I love you.
I'm never going to see you again, am I?
No.
I love you.
Tell the baby about me.
I will.
And scene. Curiously, sounds just like my performance every week here on Massacre Theater. If you know what film Maddie and I just massacred, send us an email along with your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, July 9th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries, and I'm guessing there will be a lot of them this week, and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at filmspotting.net.
You mean there's going to be two other guys in on the deal? We ain't gonna know who they are?
That's right. You don't know who they are, and they don't know who you are. That makes sense to you, doesn't it?
Well, yes, I guess so, but I...
Makes sense to me, all right. How come we need them, though, Johnny? What are they gonna do?
One of them's for the job with a rifle. None of you boys can handle that, even if you were willing to. And the other one starts the fight in the bar.
These other fellas, how much are they cutting in for? Not that I mind. Anything you do is okay, but...
These men are not going to be in on the basic scheme. They're getting paid to perform certain definite duties at a certain definite time, and they're not cutting in on the take.
Maddie, you recently mentioned to me that you had a chance to catch up with Robert Altman's great film noir satire, The Long Goodbye.
It is challenging Major League for number one on my list.
Wow.
It is that
good.
You
loved it that much.
I loved it.
It really is that good. I agree. And you loved Elliot Gould in it, and you also loved Sterling Hayden, who we get to see here in his prime. He's actually playing a really similar role to the character he plays in John Huston's classic heist movie, The Asphalt Jungle, which a lot of people wanted to see in our heist marathon, but actually part of our film noir marathon already discussed, so we couldn't include it. But we do have Sterling Hayden here as Johnny, the guy who has put together this caper at the racetrack for $2 million. He's got it all planned out meticulously down to the very minute. It's all going to work out, or so he thinks. This film is Kubrick's second feature-length film after Killer's Kiss, and he collaborated with the great crime novelist, the hard-boiled crime novelist Jim Thompson, who also wrote The Getaway, as Jeremy, the film noir geek, one of our listeners, made sure to point out to us. We're going to have that film coming up in our marathon. But he wrote Population 1280 and a lot of great stuff. And you have them collaborating here on The Killing, this grand heist movie in a lot of ways. And what I'm curious about with your reaction to this film, Maddie, is did you see early on in Kubrick's career here the makings of the wonderful filmmaker he ended up to be, the real master?
I can see the makings of it, certainly, but not his telltale sort of film style, those long shots that he's become famous for.
I don't know. It's there a little bit.
This film is really perfunctory, though. He's really sort of economic here. I mean, it clips. It clips along, and there's one scene that epitomizes this film. It's when all the hoods, they're just these sort of regular Joe Schmoes. They really are, sitting around a table, and the details of their heist are being laid out. And these men move in and out of the shadow, and the camera sort of follows them as they fall all over themselves to figure out what's going on. And that's what Kubrick does so well here. He masterfully puts the audience in and out of the light.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to piece things together just as these guys are trying to piece things together. And then, of course, there's the amazing revelation towards the end of the film is everything we're told that's going to happen happens. It plays out exactly as it's stated.
Mm-hmm.
Everything left unknown, however, to the audience and to the crooks is up in the air. And of course, that's where the best parts of this movie lie, especially in that ending.
Yeah, no, and you're right about the fact that this movie may be the most economical and just, you know, put the gas pedal down and drive to the end of any film maybe I've ever seen. It's 83 minutes long, and it's just...
What I love is he's got this sort of motley crew of guys, and there's no time for backstory.
No.
We're
going to
fill
it.
We're going to fill everything in, and if not, we're going to make up our own. We know what these guys want. We're going to make their stakes, and he's just going to give us little hints here and there.
Yeah.
And of course, there's this little surprising scene, this little relationship that pops up in the middle of the film. You're like, where did that come from? Bam, I'm going along with it.
No, you're right. We don't get any of that backstory. Certainly The Asphalt Jungle tries to set up a little bit more to the Sterling Hayden character, so we're a little bit more invested in him. Here, it just pretends that, you know what, you basically know the backstory. He's with his sweet girlfriend. They want to have the life they've always wanted. It's like every heist movie that probably came before it and is going to come after it. One last big score.
That's why they call it money.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
Yeah, no, you're really right. And I did like this film a lot, and I have seen The Killing before. It's the one film in the marathon I'd actually seen already. And I really liked it even more this time, because what I didn't notice the first time is the way it was shot. You said how, you know, the makings are there, but it doesn't have all his telltale kind of signature shots. You're right, except in the use of some long takes. They're not very long. The scenes themselves are pretty short. But if you watch the beginning of the film, just as it uses this almost Rashomon-like structure of seeing the same scene mm-hmm. repeated over and over again, you get the exact same camera shot setting up every scene. So we meet a certain character from the heist with his wife, or, you know, goes to meet the other character, whoever it might be. We see them and the camera starts left to right and actually follows them into the room in this great tracking shot. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, this is not only a heist movie, but a great film noir. You're right. The black and white photography, the use of shadows, the vertical angles, it's all there.
The femme fatale.
The femme fatale, yeah. It's all there. But he uses that repetition of these camera shots and these great long takes in the same way, mimicking the story structure and the narration, which is really great. And I was wondering what he was really onto there, other than just being flashy, other than it being, you know, really cool to look at, and of course, following the structure. And I did find a great essay online, and I forget the name of the author. I'll try to link to it in the show notes for this. But he actually makes the point that I didn't catch on to, Maddie, that when things start to unravel at the end of the film, when things go wrong and he gets off his schedule and he's 15 minutes late and it throws everything about the end of the film off, the long takes that start these scenes start to come from right to left. Kubrick actually throws off the way the scenes are envisioned, just like the whole scheme has become undone.
That's so interesting to me, because they really didn't call attention to themselves to me at all. Now, this is your second viewing, so you were kind of on guard for it. But when I think of Kubrick, I think of The Shining and those shots that would just come down the hall very slowly, very deliberately, eyes wide shut again. 2001. Here, I didn't quite get that. I really felt that he was sort of clipping along, but you're absolutely right. This camera sort of follows these guys as they meander around the room. You're absolutely right. But for me, you hit on it in your introduction. This is Sterling Hayden's movie. He makes his film. And a lot of people, of course, would recognize Sterling Hayden as the cop from The Godfather, of
Punches
course.
Punches Michael.
Exactly. And he waltzes through this film like Robert Mitchum, sort of Russell Crowe. He's just got this air about him as this everyman, but also with a heart. And I just, that's an amazing trick to pull off. He's very, very human. And then, of course, you get that last shot.
It's amazing.
Just crippling. Absolutely crippling. The look on his face is, I mean, it kills me, because it's so human. I mean, these are just a bunch of average Joe Blows, and of course they trip all over themselves, and it's so human. It's like you and I trying to pull something
off. No, he says, what's the use? And you absolutely know what he's saying. You get it there in that moment. And we should give some credit here to one of our listeners. Leonard Bushell wrote in. I hope I'm saying that right, Leonard. He says, as far as The Killing is concerned, tell me the last scene isn't one of the most heartbreaking scenes ever. And it really is, because of Sterling Hayden, but also, I'm sorry to geek out a little bit here, but because of the shot. Because of that last shot, the end of the film, where we literally see the words "the end" and we see the two FBI guys or whatever staring at him and staring at us, looking right at the camera. The way that shot is photographed, that composition is so great and so imposing. It makes you uneasy sitting on my couch. It did for me. And it actually mimics two shots earlier in the film. One with the guy at the firing range, who he gets to shoot the horse, and he's got those stand-in figures that he his targets. That's mimicked there. And also later, when everything comes undone back at the safe house, when they're supposed to divvy up the money and the gunfight happens, it's that same shot we see later in the film. It's just a great, brilliant visual stroke that I think only Kubrick and a handful of other directors would give us in a heist movie like
this. Yeah, it really sort of reminded me of the works of Edward Hopper. I don't know what it was. It's sort
of
the darkness. Those guys are straight out of Nighthawks. I absolutely love that. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Timothy Carey's performance as Nicky Arcane. He's the guy that is hired to shoot the horse. Wow. He steals every single scene he's in. I mean, he is just this blue-collar guy, gritting cutting through his teeth. He's basically John Turturro before John Turturro
anything. Yeah.
And then Elisha Cook. I mean, I love this guy. He's got the flashier role as this guy that is married to this mall. He tries to please her, and of course she's going to be his downfall. And another thing I wanted to point out, I think this film works because it is so economic. It's economic in its use of violence. There's no blood. Of course, this is during the Hays Code, and I actually think it's to the betterment of the movie. And of course, Kubrick's going to actually prove that he knows how to use blood to the extreme later on, Full Metal Jacket, yeah. Everything we see from him, you know, from The Shining onward.
Uh-huh.
But here, it actually works. It's really, really sort of stylized. It worked for me.
Yeah, you make a great point, but it's funny that you mentioned the code, because I specifically thought that it could be a downfall with the film. I'm so aware of the code now in action because of our class where mm-hmm. we watch all these Hawks and Curtis films, and they had to deal with all these code issues. And here it is. When you know the code is at work, you do lose a little bit of suspense because you know they're going to get punished in the end. You know how it's going to play out. No one who shoots someone else isn't going to be punished and not die themselves. Someone who steals or commits a crime, they're going to be punished. So you know where the film's going when you're aware of the code.
That's a good point. I didn't go there. What I'm actually referring to is the gore on screen. We don't actually have to see, you know, the Bonnie and Clyde riddled with
you're
bloody
right.
bullets.
And I agree
I'm actually
with
talking to the gore. I think it actually works. I love it. People just fall over when they hear a bang. I'll go with it. Just
yeah.
act, okay?
No, I agree with you there on that point, absolutely. And I do just think that beyond the way the film is shot, and it works just as a great heist film, but there is this larger thematic issue at work here, I think, that Kubrick is dealing with, where you have this character who has meticulously planned this out, but what it boils down to is you cannot control everything. The plan accounts for everything but human frailty. The George character talking to his wife and his jealousy there, how that backfires. You have this idea at work that everything has a breaking point where order is going to fail. The track is something that runs like clockwork, but all it takes is one outside force to throw everything off, to throw everything into chaos. And I think that Kubrick's almost saying that the real sin that Sterling Hayden commits here isn't that he's trying to outwit the police and commit a crime. It's that he's trying to outwit nature. He's trying to control the order of things. It just doesn't work.
Exactly. And you're talking about a gang of really, really vulnerable humans, of course. You've got Unger, of course. He's going to show his own vulnerability mm-hmm. halfway through the film. And I love the way, especially in those moments, when he starts to see the little ways that his plan could unravel, those are brilliant. Just really soft moments that really speak to the ability of Hayden here.
Well, sounds like we both had a good time with The Killing. If you haven't seen it, you do need to check it out. And next week, our third film in our heist movies marathon will be Jules Dassin's Rififi. For the complete classic heist lineup, please visit the marathons page at filmspotting.net. And Maddie, actually, I just found, I did have it in my notes, the comment about the right to left changing up of the long takes. Thomas Nelson, he had an article in 1982 called Kubrick Inside an Artist's Maze. So just wanted to give proper credit there.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we return, Adam and I pile into the old film spotting camper and head to Devil's Tower. Adam?
Of course I can do it. What do you think? Boo, 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 boo.
For some close encounters.
I can't believe you made me sing twice in the show.
Top five kind with our top movies to teach an alien about Earth. Wow, that was brutal.
Awful.
Stay with us.
Sitting in a town in New Mexico, named after a game show, trying to decide if I should sell my van by truck. Down to Texas. Sometimes I think I'm gunning for the big time. Sometimes I think I'm running out of time. And the big odometer in the sky turned over. Hey, big odometer in the sky just turned over.
We want to take a moment now to announce the winner of our most recent Spout contest. You can check out all our contests and all our great entries over at filmgaming.spout.com. We wanted to know what your top five movies to teach an alien about Earth are. You're going to hear ours here in a minute on the show. But Maddie, let's announce the winner. The grand prize winner of some swanky American Apparel Spout swag is
Bav Motors 1, who offers this list. Number one, Contact. The alien has searched the big-ass sky to find tiny Earth. Contact relates what the experience is like for humankind. The search for alien life might be the only similar effort the two species share. The question Eleanor Arroway asks at the end is one I think we'd hope to get the answer to. You know, as long as we're talking. Number two, Blood Diamond. Of all the geopolitical movies out there, an exposition of the ultra-poor dying so the ultra-rich can have, or even worse, lock away in a box, symbolic trinkets that neither feed nor clothe them is probably the most telling. Well, that's pretty provocatively and nicely put. Number three, Legends of the Fall. The story of the most important unit in human interaction, family, intertwined with race, war, romance, human frailty, nature, and economics, albeit all North American variations, would give a sense of what cannot be taught, human love.
Bav Motors 1 also has the number 4 pick, The Shawshank Redemption. Hope is the most important human emotion, love being a subset of hope, in my opinion. And to quote a different movie, hope, it is the quintessential human delusion, simultaneously the source of your greatest triumph and your greatest weakness. Also a fairly accurate description of how prisoners are treated would be educational, according to Pearl S. Buck and Winston Churchill. Maddie, some history here. You can appreciate that number 4 pick.
Very nice, very nice.
And number 4, my favorite choice, Predator. The message here, don't F with us. Perhaps the alien being is so far advanced that the destruction of Earth and or humankind is laughably easy, but they should know, we go down fighting. So, some great picks there from Bav Motors 1. Congratulations. The fine people over at Spout.com will be in touch with you. And we want to give out a runner-up award here, Maddie. We're going to hand out, we're going to send out the DVD, the new Batman the Movie Special Edition on Blu-ray disc. Now, this is the 1966 Batman the Movie, yes, that you mentioned recently on the show with Adam West. Spout really liked how one of the users, Alexa Schlosser, changed up the conversation to include the top 5 movies to confuse an alien about Earth, and Leroy711 responded with this great list. Take it away, Matt.
Number 1, Delicatessen. Yeah, we eat each other. Number 2, Night of the Living Dead. Sometimes it gets out of hand. Number 3, American Movie. This is a documentary of our president. Number 4, The Doom Generation. Another gripping documentary. And number 5, Brazil, and we all lived happily ever after. Very nicely done.
Yeah, Leroy711, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will mail out your DVD copy of Batman the Movie. We also want to announce our new contest. We're going back to the recasting couch, Maddie. Mm. We're going to take the red pill and recast The Matrix, Maddie.
What?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Because, why not?
Jeez, why don't you just colorize Casablanca while you're at it and recast Rick?
Now, those are some bold statements there, but for those who gripe about Keanu Reeves in
this
movie...
Who gripes about Keanu Reeves? He is perfect in this movie.
Good point. I don't know. It's time to put your money where your mouth is and pick a better Neo. But can anyone fill Hugo Weaving's shoes? Spout says they've been imagining other actors saying, Mr. Anderson, and they all just seem wrong. We want to see what you come up with. Recast The Matrix at filmgaming.spout.com.
I'm recusing myself.
You're
going to
recuse?
I am not going to be part of this blasphemy.
Well, I can't wait to see what our listeners come up with. Again, filmgaming.spout.com. The grand prize winner is going to win some great American Apparel Spout swag. A runner-up is going to get another copy of Batman the Movie Special Edition.
Lately, I've been scattered. My attention span is like a 3-year-old.
I didn't feel I had to. I have a clear conscience because a number of other people who'd come to visit me in Winnipeg from far-flung places had come away uttering the same strange things, that they too had been enchanted somehow. So I did set out with an actual documentarian's open mind to try to find out just what it was that was behind these enchantments.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that was Guy Madden, the director of My Winnipeg, a film we both saw and loved at the Toronto Film Festival last September. We had a chance, obviously, to talk with Mr. Madden there at the festival and had a great time learning about that film. And it's out now in theaters in limited release. If you're in a major city, you can probably catch My Winnipeg. And we really just wanted to play that clip to shine a little light on it. If it's in your area, you do need to check it out.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about this a little bit, I don't know, about a month or two ago. We had a brief conversation about these films that Film Spotting really identifies as one they want to get behind, as one we really want to champion. That's really not the format of our show, again, to say, go see this film, go spend your money here. But there are those films that come along, and I think this is one that we would definitely recommend you check out.
We would, and we actually got an email just this past week from a listener, I should have written it down, who said, hey, I never would have seen this movie or heard of it if it wasn't for your show, and I loved it, one of my favorite movies of the year. So if you do have a chance, we would urge you to go see Guy Madden's My Winnipeg. This week's top five, it is apropos really of nothing, I guess, though it does tie in some way with Will Smith and Independence Day and Aliens,
Men in Black,
July 4th.
Sure.
Top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. Maddie, how did you approach this? What's your list?
Man, it's so wide open. I didn't really know where to start. Am I just going to send them like a bunch of documentaries? Am I just going to send them The Wire, you know, that kind of stuff? I figure, you know, they're aliens. They know how to get here. They're probably pretty familiar with Earth as a whole. So I don't know. I just they're pretty random, but
here
we go.
They're sailors. They're here to party.
Yeah, exactly. Go get them, Ray. All right. Well, nine number five is Apocalypse Now.
Really?
You know, on this Earth, we do wars pretty well. We also do tractor pulls really well. And we'll use anything as an excuse for war, religion, money, but it's usually just about power. Adam, as you know, I don't love this film. I actually think it's really sort of bloated, but I think it captures the insanity of what war is really beautifully.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. A good choice there. For my list, the way I approached it really was just trying to get movies that deal in some way with the human condition. And I didn't want them to be really kind of myopic little films, movies that just deal with relationships or, you know, a lot of listeners wrote in and they made great choices, but they were about, you know, I want a movie that's about love. So pick a great love story, maybe even like a When Harry Met Sally or something. That was a little too small for me. I want to give them something that tries to really give these aliens, of course I overthought this, Maddie, give these aliens a sense of what it means to be human. That was my approach.
So from the mind of Antonioni, we have...
Well, sort of. Going back to our poll question this week, my number five is Amores Perros, the Alejandro González Iñárritu film. You have three interconnected stories all hooked together by a car accident in Mexico City, and it's largely about cruelty and suffering, but there also are some moments of real kindness and beauty there, and I would have gone with Babel or Babel, Maddie, in deference to you, because it is on a much grander scale. I mean, really there, he's trying to connect all these people around the world, but I kind of loathe that film, so I had to go with Amores Perros, my number five.
Great choice. All right, well, my number four is Vernon Florida.
Good pick.
I'm leaving it to other countries to send films that really sort of exemplify their specific cultures and way of life. You could almost go with any Errol Morris film. I mean, of course, he's a big favorite here on Film Spotting. I adore this little film. It's far too easy to laugh at the residents of this town and say, oh my God, these people, they're ridiculous freaks. No, actually, they're not. They're what we call human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the aliens need to see this.
Sounds like it belonged on my list. My number four, I think this is actually the first time, believe it or not, it's ever made a top five list of mine here on Film Spotting. And it's such an obvious choice in many ways. Along with the human condition, you have what defines us as human beings. And you've got this absolutely inspirational movie, It's a Wonderful Life. You got to have a little Capricorn on this list, I think, where you've got people at their best coming together to help their fellow man out. I don't want to show that to these aliens, but it's also about the search for meaning in your life. What is my purpose? Why was I put here? Would the world be better off without me? Those are fundamental human questions.
All right, great pick. Well, my number three, well, I figured, you know, science fiction. You know, I thought about Star Wars. I thought about Independence Day. But I figured, look, these aliens know how to get here. They're probably just going to laugh at everything we put up there.
Yeah.
So I figure, why not go whole hog? I'm sending them The Day the Earth Stood Still. You've got Klaatu. He tries to save us from ourselves and, of course, tries to save us from the army of Gorts stationed just beyond the galaxy, poised to wipe us out if we can't all live in peace. Again, getting back to that, you know, the idea of war and peace. Basically, I'm asking the alien, can you help us out a little bit?
I hear you. Well, my number three, Maddie, let's go ahead and hear a clip, and it's along the sci-fi realm, just as your number three was.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
That's, of course, from a movie that for a while was in my penalty box but has been let out. I will take advantage of any chance to play one of my all-time favorite movie speeches and favorite death scenes, Rutger Hauer there in Blade Runner. The fundamental question, again, of this film, what makes us human? And the answers that Ridley Scott and Philip K. Dick, of course, explore largely surrounds our memories and their authenticity. But there's also this great expression of desire to simply live and experience the beauty of life, the wonders of the world. You hear it there in that great speech from Rutger Hauer at the end of the film. So it's my number three.
Great choice. All right. Well, my number two is Do the Right thing. Hopefully these aliens look kind of like us, because we have an unfortunate history on this planet of disliking people that don't look like us. Not only is this a brilliant, brilliant film, but for my money, if I wanted to encompass sort of the hatred, the ignorance, the love, the insanity of our race relations, this is the film I would choose.
That is a wonderful choice. I'm a little hurt, though, Maddie, that you didn't ask me to sing Fight the Power.
Go for it.
I would not punish our listeners in that way. Speaking of punishing, my number two film...
The Punisher with Thomas Jane?
No, but that's a professional segue, people. Grave of the Fireflies. Of course, a big favorite here on Film Spotting. Maddie's already yawning. I'm sorry. The Isao Takahata film. It's set near the end of World War II in Japan. And I picked it for some of the same reasons I did Amores Perros, but even more so. I just think it captures the entire gamut of human emotions and experiences. You've got love, compassion, beauty, honor, but also terrible cruelty and horror and suffering and pettiness. It's all there. It's the single most depressing movie I've ever seen, but I absolutely adore it as well.
No, I do think it's a great pick. I just know that we talk about it on this show sort of endlessly.
It hasn't come and up for a good 20
it
shows.
It never had that impact on me. It
really?
Never did. I watched it, and like I watched WALL-E, and man, it got dusty in the theater at least four or five times. I watched that film for whatever it was. It was the animation that alienated me. I never really felt for that situation. I do want to check it out, because I think you're right. I do think it is a solid film. I never had the visceral reaction that you did.
Forget getting dusty. I had a full-blown allergic reaction to Grave of the Fireflies.
Man, well, I got to check it out again.
I'm gonna
put it up, number one. All right, well, my number one, Adam, you kind of touched on this with your Capra pick at number three. It is Wizard of Oz.
Mm.
I mean, the fact of the matter is I stole this pretty much from WALL-E last week. He was watching Hello, Dolly. Look, we've been entertaining, reassuring, instructing ourselves by reenacting stories through, you know, several mediums now for hundreds and hundreds of years. This is just a wonderful film with hope and with dreams. And then, of course, at the end of the day, Adam, at the end of the day, this little planet, what can we say? There's no place like home.
What a great ending point there. Sadly, I have to make my number one pick, and it is another sci-fi film. It's such an obvious cliched choice, but I can't help it. Let's go ahead and roll in the theme music here. There it is. I would have called it, Maddie, the 2001 Memorial List, but I didn't like any of my other choices well enough to bump it off. A little more Kubrick love here on this week's Film Spotting. It's actually the first movie that popped into my head when this topic was posed to us, and I mentioned wanting to encompass all of the human condition, something that was universal. Well, we go from the dawn of man to the star child here with this film, and I found a quote on the greatest film site, filmsite.org, where the writer said, "Many consider the masterpiece bewildering, boring, slow-moving, or annoying, but are still inspired by its story of how man is dwarfed by technology and space." Well, that's bang on. I consider it at times bewildering. Well, almost all the time bewildering. Boring at times, slow-moving, and annoying, but you know what? I am still inspired by it. It's absolutely a masterpiece and really the obvious choice for a number one here on this list. Maddie, what about some honorable mentions? Did you have any?
Yes, I had Babel, or Babel,
mm-hmm.
Casablanca, The Gods Must Be Crazy, Ernest Saves Christmas, and Hoosiers.
It's too bad we don't have a whole nother show to talk about the Ernest Saves Christmas choice.
Have you seen that film?
No, I have not.
Oh, yeah, you and your Antonioni. I love it. Give it a chance.
Was
give
that
it a chance.
Fellini? Was that Fellini, the follow-up to
I'm
Eight
checking
and a half?
Out Grave of the Fireflies. You're putting Ernest in your queue.
I don't know about that. My honorable mentions, The Iron Giant, Do the Right Thing, definitely a strong contender for my list. A movie you don't like, Maddie, The Fountain. Gates of Heaven, I had to have a little Errol Morris love on my list. Magnolia and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, all movies that were trying to edge on to my list.
Well, this conversation can serve no purpose. Goodbye. Those are our top five movies to teach an alien about Earth. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
On next week's show, Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy 2. We will have our review of it, and Maddie's Movie Minute might take on a movie I saw at Sundance, The Whackness, with Ben Kingsley in that one. And we don't have a top five yet for that week. We do have some suggestions rolling in. If you've got one for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. Wanted to tease as well a little bit down the road, Maddie. Looking at our calendar, we're going to share our top five performances of the year so far in a couple weeks, and then we're going to share our top five movies of the year so far later this month. And of course, we do have some special guests planned for those shows. Check the calendar page at filmspotting.net for updates.
Thanks as always to Candace for her invaluable production assistance, and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela, and special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Dan Byrne and Messenger Records for this week's music.
Yeah, Dan Byrne, you were right, Maddie. We haven't featured him in a while on the show, and I just wanted to quickly mention that he's doing a couple concerts here coming up, I believe July 7th, and he's in a play on July 10th in the Cedar Rapids area doing some benefit work for the flooding in that area. So I just wanted to send a shout out that way. And if you want to learn more about those events, danbyrne.com, click on tour.
Please do check that out. All right, for more information, learn more at messengerrecords.com. The mass of humanity swarmed the defenseless ramparts of Burrito Beach, a pack of jackals circling their reef-fried carrions to leg tights of drool dripping down the front of their fatigues, elastic waistbands and sweatshirts proclaiming their adoration for Keith Urban and some Maoist dictator called Branson. A quick reconnoiter revealed that the outside of their military transport read Greater Crystal Lake JCs, but they weren't fooling anyone. This was no longer simply the Wahoo rest stop and way station. This was a war zone. We were under attack, and we dug in near the gift shop, expecting a prolonged assault. So this is it, I thought. This is how I meet my end, torn limb to limb by rabid Iowans in the middle of nowhere on the vast steppes of Nebraska. Thank God, I thought. At least I'm wearing my film-spotting T-shirt, purchased on a whim from filmspottingswag.com, a nest of capitalistic integrity perching amidst the rabid jungle of porn that is the series of tubes. Filmspottingswag.com, an oasis for T-shirts and offering maybe, just maybe, a last shred of dignity for mankind. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Oscar Acosta. Hunter S. Thompson is rolling in his grave somewhere. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
It is the Tower of Babel.
No, it's not.
It is the Tower of Babel.
You can say it technically you can say it both ways, but it's where we got the word Babel from, so that's why people say Babel.
Right, but
the movie is called Babel.
But it's Babel.
It's called Babel.
It's Babel. It's the Tower of Babel.
The movie's
called
Babel.
Have you
read
your Bible? Yes. It is the Tower of Babel.
The movie's called Babel.
But they're mispronouncing it. I can't stand for that.
Oh.
It just created the genre. It's absolutely brilliant. Run out and see it.
Damn it. We'd have so many more listeners if we were really like that.
The killing kills me. We just did it like, like Paul Lynn the entire. I just love this film. Go out and see it. That's more Charles Nelson Reilly. But
yeah, it was.
Center Square says, see the killing, it kills. What do you say, Brett? Hey, Gene.